Welcome to the Inner Fight Endurance Podcast, episode number 201. I've been left to do the introduction on my own for this week because Tom, Rob Foster, and Marcus are all currently in Kenya running with, well, some of the best runners, cyclists, and endurance athletes on the planet. Basically getting it handed to them every single day for the next week. If you've not seen what they're up to, head over to the Inner Fight Endurance Instagram or Tom Walker's Instagram or Rob Foster's Instagram or Marcus's Instagram. Very, very easy to find. I don't know the handles off by heart, but you're smart people. I'm sure you could find it. And see what they're doing, see where they're running, see what they're up to. Every time they go, I watch and I get FOMO. But I'm a smart man. I know that if I went, I would just get dropped, probably in the warm-up in all of these runs. It's a very cool place. Looking forward to catching up with Tom when he gets back and finding out a lot more about it. Thank you for all of those that listened to our 200th show. Been getting some great feedback from that about the one thing you need to ensure success in endurance. If you're listening to this show, it's probably more than likely that you listened to the last show. And if you've not listened to the last show, show 200, then head back and listen to that. This week in the community, we have our second trail running camp of the season. We'll be heading to Shoka Valley, the OG of Dubai trail running, if you like. Friday night, that's Friday the 10th of November, starting anywhere from 4:30. We'll be running distances from 8 up to 25 kilometers on Friday night. We'll finish, we'll camp, we'll have a barbecue, we'll have some chats. People can go home if they want or stay if they want. That's fine. Saturday morning, we'll start at 5:59. Again, distances ranging from 8 to 24 kilometers. Rolling hills in the Shoka Valley. It will be fantastic. If you want to get involved, this will go out on Wednesday, this show. If you want to get involved, you have Thursday to send me a message or an email, rj@innerfight.com. I will send you all the details and you can join us for Trail Running Camp 2. What else do we have? That's it. That's all I want to promote. I'm doing the intro. I don't want to talk about anything else. Let's get on to today's show. Today, we have a very special guest. Tom interviewed this guy a few weeks ago. He's a very nice man. He works for Oakley. He does everything. You'll see him running around Dubai. You'll see him riding around Dubai on road bikes, mountain bikes. He actually, I think, has more bikes than any other human I know, and some really, really cool bikes. And Tom will get into that when they talk to Colin. That's it. Here it is. Tom talking to Colin from Oakley.
Colin, welcome to the show and thank you for coming on.
Morning.
We've just had fully done a mini podcast before we've started this this main one. Right, tell us first of all, just introduce yourself to our listeners. What is you do, where you're from? Give us the lowdown.
Sure. So my name is Colin Allen, originally from South Africa. I think we've kind of been digital nomads before it was kind of cool to be a digital nomad. I've lived in quite a few different countries. Currently based in Dubai, looking after the brand Oakley for 69 countries. So we've got the whole African continent, the whole of the Middle East, and then all those interesting countries around the Middle East, plus Malta, Cyprus, Turkey, Israel, and a few other interesting countries. And that's total brand. So marketing, sales, PR events, sponsorships. So quite busy.
So when you see us running around with Oakley glasses and nice cycling helmets, you're the man. You're the reason why.
Correct. Well, you're the reason why, right?
Well, yeah. Takes two. Takes two to tango. Mate, we chatted a bit about what you would like to come on and talk about. And we've talked about why you're here in terms of your brand partner, but your also knowledge within endurance space and the sport and things. And we'll cover a few bases there, but I'd like to start with what being involved with a company like Oakley that has such a long history within endurance sport, what's that like for you?
So it's quite interesting. I mean, I think the first thing is boys love to race, right? And I think my earliest memory was on the plastic little scooter push run bikes that my daughter now races around on, you know, trying to beat the kid next door. And so I've been competitive for as long as I remember. And You know, whether we're playing Uno or we're going for a jog, you know, we have to try and win. And so growing up, there was always five brands I wanted to work for, and Oakley was always there. So first and foremost, I'm actually a fan of the brand. And the opportunity to work for it has been, and I don't want to sound cliche and sort of say a dream come true, but it really is an honor and a privilege to be able to really be a part of and direct and really sort of move the brand, especially to go into this new sort of next 50 years of the brand as a fan. So I think the brand has always been prevalent. It started in 1983 with eyewear, and we actually started performance eyewear. So before that, people were either racing and running without anything or with their normal reading glasses or, you know, a few other more sort of lifestyle brands maybe. But in 83 with Greg LeMond at the Tour de France with Eyeshade, you know, that was born. And so we have a deep heritage within performance. And now today, being the number one performance eyewear brand in the world, we continue to push into that space. And so everything we do, form and function and performance, is at its heart. So even if you got a pair of casual glasses, you could go and run a marathon with them. And so it also becomes quite tricky because people say, oh, which pair should I use for cycling? Which pair should I use for running? And the answer is always the same. Like, we have the best lenses in the world, so you choose what suits your style, you know? And so it's really great that we can go across all that space. But at the same time, we are involved with so many different sports that it's quite hard sometimes to really sort of focus in on what you want to do and how you want to do it. And so we keep having these realignment meetings of like, what is our actual core focus? Because we can go everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a really interesting time at the moment.
It's one of the themes I was thinking of when we were chatting about this show, and so much has evolved in endurance sport. Shoes have obviously dramatically changed. Bikes are changing every 2 or 3 years. The design of a bike looks like it's going to change. Wheels, tri-suits,
yep.
You know, everything. But one thing has always remained a staple of it, and that's eyewear, or Oakley's.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even within the brand, we've moved from iridium to prism from a lens point of view. We go to the mesomorphic lenses now, which is Kato, which is the one that's sort of shaped over your nose. And so I think technology has allowed us to produce product differently. We're always upgrading. So we always, little upgrades we don't even sometimes talk about, similar to the bike or the car industry, where they just fix little problems without you even knowing that they did it, and you don't have to have a big marketing campaign around it.
Yeah.
But definitely if you, and I mean, I have Oakley's, I actually have the original from 1983 as well in my collection, and I do often go and run with it just for a vibe. And it is very different to the new stuff that we've launched, okay. Right? So I think even with an eyewear, but for sure, it hasn't been the giant leaps that we've had in some of the other areas around nutrition, training, you know, footwear and bicycles, for sure.
Yeah. There's those crazy ones that wrapped back over your head.
Over the tops, yeah. I have a few of those in my collection. I actually run and actually race a few times with them, and it's always, like, if I'm not that fit and I'm going to go race, I often use them because it's just the reactions from the crowds as you run around really just makes me smile and laugh and kind of makes the suffering a bit easier. And they're super comfortable. They're actually my favorite, most comfortable thing to wear. But also I don't have hair, so it probably fits me a bit better than most.
Makes a difference. You've got an amazing insight into the company that probably the general public wouldn't have. How does a company stay? I mean, it's going to come up to 50 years soon. You were just talking about that. How do they stay at the forefront of their own industry and what they do?
Sure. One of my favorite quotes was actually from Pete Sampras, who was one of my favorite tennis players growing up. And he said, it's a lot easier to get to number one than to stay at number one.
Yeah.
And I think getting to number one, there's a collective of you trying to take down number one, right? You're in a bit of a group. When you're at number one, you defend against everybody else. And so staying number one becomes a lot harder than getting there. I think in the beginning, there wasn't much competition. So we were number one pretty quickly. Jim Jannard, who started the brand, was a visionary, or is a visionary. He's still alive and kicking. And I think the piece that's allowed us to stay in front for so long is innovation. Like, we haven't sat still. We haven't rested on our laurels, and we did crazy stuff even if it didn't make sense. Like, what most people might not know is Oakley went into watches, which made absolutely no sense. And we lost loads of money. They lost millions going into watches.
But in the 90s.
In the 90s, exactly.
Yeah, I remember them. Yeah.
And Jim Jannard wanted the best watches we could make that completely disrupted the industry. And it was they were all Swiss made. I have quite a few in my collection that still work perfectly, you know, 20, 30 years later. And they now become collector items. And the values obviously shot up quite a lot. And within collector circles, certain watch faces and styles, you know, go for quite a lot of money. But I think it's not sitting still. And I think you as a coach or an athlete have a similar approach to it, is that you're only as good as your last race, right? So what am I going to do better next time? How do I get that 1% improvement? The Japanese have this beautiful philosophy called Kaizen. And it's around doing something better by only 1%. So their theory is that you don't need to make big jumps. Just tomorrow, do something in your life 1% better. And then the compound effect of that over a few months would bring results. So yeah. I think we've done that as a brand. We've innovated, we've disrupted. I know a lot of brands throw the word disruptive around, but exactly like you said, Over the Tops to this day still haven't had anything come close to it from a disruptive in the industry point of view.
Yeah. Now I think when it's Oakley, everyone seems to just be accepted. One's ever like, oh, that's never going to work. It's like, oh, it's Oakley. Yeah, that makes sense. Whereas if another brand tried something, as you say, disruptive, you'd probably think, oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're also lucky that we've been kind of the bad boy for a long time. We've gone after, you know, the non-traditional athletes like Dennis Rodman, who was super controversial through his career and even post-career with what he does. And I think, like you say, we kind of get away with it. They're like, okay, Oakley can do it, but you can't, you know? Yeah. And I think friends of mine that work for other brands have said to me, they're like, oh, you know, one of your campaigns or one of your products came up, and the reaction in the boardroom was, yeah, but Oakley can do that, we can't. You know? So I think we are allowed a certain leeway when it comes to being a bit crazy or sort of going outside of that box.
Yeah. So what do you think earned you that? Must have been what you were doing when Oakley were doing back in the 80s then?
That's an interesting question. I think it's evolution, right? So I think brands evolve and sometimes find themselves in a space that wasn't necessarily planned. And I think it goes back to Jim Jannard again. I think we owe so much of where the brand is today, even though he exited in 2014 odd, I think. Because of how he started it. Like there's legendary, I just come back from Milan sales meeting where we did it in our brand center, which in itself is a very impressive building, and it's beautiful and it's great to be there and it's very business-like. Jim Jannard did it in Vegas and then took everybody to the Playboy Mansion on his private jet for the after party. Like, and I think there's probably a lot of things that happened in the 90s that we couldn't get away with today.
Yeah, right.
But I think that's what kind of established those brands, right? And people like Robin Williams, if you go back and Google Robin Williams Oakley, you see how he was such a fan of the brand, and how him and Jannard were actually friends. And, you know, we had recently with Mission Impossible, where Tom Cruise goes off on the edge on his motorbike, he's wearing a pair of Oakleys, which he developed with us for that stunt. And it's the fourth time we've actually worked with him on Mission Impossible. And so, yeah, I think it's about doing cool stuff with cool people and not worrying about the expense. Mm. I think Jim blew a lot of money doing crazy stuff that made the brand cool. And I think that legacy of just, I think once you've always done something a little bit different, you're allowed to carry on like that. I think, like we said before, when brands now start to try, they get a lot of pushback. But like you say, we already accepted that, you know, and Red Bull's another brand that's probably in a similar space to us in that
very close as together,
well.
Those brands. Yeah, I would agree. It's also, there's a distinct sort of look, but also feel. And I've been, you know, a few brands have come with various glasses and you kind of have a look at them and you think if Oakley didn't exist, these would be great.
Yes.
But they're not Oakley.
Exactly.
And so even just putting them on, you're already in like, oh, this doesn't feel, this is, you put a pair of Oakleys on and you just feel, it's almost, it's like a safety feeling.
Yeah.
It's a really, like when you dig deep into the psychology of it.
Yeah.
I can remember my first memory of Oakleys was actually from my dad who used to sail a lot and he had one of those big set of M-frames.
Yeah.
You'd never be seen dead in a casual way, but when you were on a boat, they were acceptable, or you'd ride in them. And it's that feeling of like, yeah, I know that these are. And there was a ad campaign once where you can smash a lens with a hammer and it wouldn't break.
Yeah, we still have that. We stand on our lenses all the time.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because people say, oh, my glasses can do that too. Then I say, well, give me your glasses. Let me stand on them. And then normally they don't give them to me because they're not sure if they actually can, right? So
I remember my brother taking a lens to on a brick wall with a hammer and being, and he's like, it's fine. Oakley guarantee it. Even if they break, they'll change them. So there's nothing to lose.
Exactly.
So there's definitely a feeling of safety around the brand. And there's also that you just know when someone's wearing Oakleys, you know they're a pair of Oakleys. Do you think that's to do with the logo or do you guys have like a set almost algorithm of how to make a pair of glasses that seem to fit everybody so well and everyone knows the look of them?
I think fit is something we experiment with quite a lot. So Oakley were the first people to come up with what we call the three-point fit system. So the first point is on your nose and then one on each side of your ear. And the thinking is that only those three points need to touch your face. Everything else can be floating. And right. I think a lot of the brands get that wrong where you'll feel the frame on the side of your temple, you'll feel it on your cheekbone or so. So fit is something that we work a lot with. And then we came up with extra small, which a lot of times people think is for kids, but it's actually just a narrower fit. And then we have Asian fit as well. So we've identified that, you know, an Asian face is constructed differently to a Western face. And so we addressed that many, many moons ago. And now we're coming with adjustable nose pads, three or four different nose pads with one pair of glasses, small, medium, and larges, and, you know, adjustable temples and stuff. So people can really get that personalized fit. And I think, and we touched on it earlier before the podcast when we were chatting, like, glasses sit on your face. So it's a very personal thing because it's your image. And what you wear will be judged by people when you walk in a room. Like if I walked in the room with the over-the-tops on, you would think different of me if I walked in the room without wearing something or wearing another pair of casual glasses.
You're on the camera version, look at the shirt.
Exactly, right?
The over-the-top one.
Exactly. So I think... Yeah. I think it's such a personal thing that it becomes a style thing. And what we said before is you can take any pair of Oakley glasses and go run a marathon with them because our lenses are the best. And so I think we first established the performance part of the glasses. They need to all fit well and we need to have the best lenses in the industry. And then style is second. So you can then choose which style suits you, what color suits you. And of course, we cater for, you know, from the black all the way through to the crazy, crazy designs and colors and stuff. And then lastly, you've got one pair of eyes. And I keep saying this to people that buy cheap eyewear. Is you save 200 or 300 dirhams now, dollars or whatever currency you're buying in, but you've got one pair of eyes. And so if you're not protecting them when we get to 50 and 60 and 70, some of us not so far away from that anymore, and you start to have problems, it's for life. Like we need to, and I believe, and you don't need to, I think I've got 140 odd pairs of glasses. You don't need to get to that level. But one pair of good sunglasses is one of the best investments you can make because you're protecting your eyes.
Yeah. And they last.
And they do. I mean, as I said, I've got pairs from 1983 that I could still go for a run in today. And that's almost 40 years old, right? And I can still use them and they're still good.
And I think Oakley were one of the first to, you got that really protective case.
Yep.
You know, they encourage you to look after them.
Yep.
Obviously, the price point is there. I mean, they're not as expensive as like designer glasses out there, but you're paying enough that you want to look after them.
Yep.
And then you're putting them in a nice box that makes you want to put them back in there, like you say, and you can look after them. So they're definitely something that you would, it's not really an investment, but they're something that you should put good money into and they'll last you a long time.
Yep.
I feel the same thing that Oakley does that with their athletes as well. You kind of have a lot of athletes, seem to have a lot of athletes in Oakley, but they seem to get a lot for it. And you're just chatting to us about what you're going to do at the Olympics next year in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that and what that, I mean, it sounds amazing really what you're developing for it and something you should almost think should be quite simple that other people have thought of, but it obviously hasn't been and you guys are going to do it.
Yeah. So I think one of the first things we do is you know, similar to yourself and the relationship that we have, is that we call it Oakley family. Like it's not about us sponsoring. And I've always said to people I've worked with, because they say, oh, we're going to sign a contract or we get, and I said, listen, if we're at a point where you're only staying with us because we've signed something, the relationship is damaged and it's better that you leave anyway, right? So I'm not a big fan of these big contracts. Obviously, if you're the big Mbappes, you need to have it legally and, you know, there's quite a few million being paid across, so I guess you need to have it. But we we are very lucky in that if Olympics is a great example, like we would sponsor maybe 200 or 250 odd athletes at Olympics, but there's probably 800 athletes at Olympics wearing our brand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that goes to the testament of the brand is that if you're serious about sport, you generally are in a pair of Oakleys. And that's not from an arrogance point of view from the brand. And I'm still competitive today myself, and I still go to quite a lot of races around the world. And 80% of the field will be wearing Oakley, yeah, and maybe 1% of the field will actually be sponsored. So it's, we're in a very fortunate position where we don't need to go out and sponsor that many people, number one. Number two, often just product sponsors, like guys are just happy to get product sponsorship, and then be part of that family. And we've generally found that once you're in the Oakley family, you don't leave. I've been working with athletes personally for 15 years that still, you know, stay with us. And they've had other offers. They've had other cash offers from other brands, you know, but they don't want to leave because the product is so good. And like you say, they believe in it. They feel safe. It works for them. And with sports, I think if you're on a formula that works, you generally don't mess with that formula, right? So I think it's something that the athlete doesn't have to think about. They just know they put on the Oakleys, and that piece is not have to be a worry. It's not, what am I going to wear? What? It's just, it's there, you know, and that part of your sort of thing is done.
Yeah. But you're developing something for the Olympic athletes.
Yes.
To start with. Can you talk about that or not?
Yeah, we could chat about it a bit. We're launching something early next year. We're launching two things early next year. We're launching a brand new performance piece for the Olympics. So we've kind of looked through our range, and two of our best-selling styles is a Radar and a Flak, from a sports performance point of view, and they're quite dated. And again, that shows you that, like, there's not many things in today's world. Maybe Cervelo P3, the original P3, you still see a lot of them around because it was so ahead of its time. But, I mean, Radar, I think, came out in 94, 95 maybe, or maybe late 90s. So that's almost a 20-year-old style. And yet you go to a race and 20%, 30% of the field will still be wearing it. So I think that, again, goes back to the brand, and just it's so good and so comfortable and just works that people just go, it's their go-to, right? But for us as a brand, we wanted to develop that a bit further. So we're launching to a sports style and a split lens style, which is the performance piece for Olympics early next year. And then we decided to look at the athlete holistically and say, okay, so we got him covered during his competition. Let's call it on-field, right? But what about off-field? What about the distractions they have? What about the noise? And if you've ever been to Olympics, and I've been lucky enough to attend Olympics in London and also, you know, some other big sporting events throughout my career, they're noisy. And if you ever watch Superbikes or a Grand Prix, you can't even talk to someone next to you because of that noise. So it's that noise around the athletes all the time that we decided to address. So we're launching a lifestyle piece, which is a large frame and has protection from that noise, which is kind of, I guess, the most I can say about it at the moment. But it's basically, if you have our pair of eyewear on and you have a pair of headphones, you would literally block out the world. And then leading into that, we have the Oakley Safe House, which we built, or we're busy in the process of finalizing in Paris, which is a safe space for the athletes to go. I think they would get, especially the more popular and the more famous the athlete, they would just get bugged from the moment they wake up all the way through to the night. And that emotional energy, because it's quite weird as someone famous, like if you don't stop and greet the fans, you're an arsehole. And with social media today, you get canceled almost instantly, right? So they're obliged to having to kind of always be nice to everyone. But that's draining and takes a lot of energy. So then what you find is they just avoid a lot of those situations. But then they have the same effect on social media of like, oh, he doesn't care about his fans. He doesn't care about his people. So it's just, as a really sort of professional top athlete, I think it's a fine balance of how much you give to the fans or not. And so we created in the process of finalizing a safe space for them to go to where you're not allowed to talk to them. It's not that you're not allowed to, but it's, you don't engage with them. You don't take selfies with them. You don't try and get their attention. You don't try and, you know, talk to them. They can come there and they can be almost infamous. Like nobody will bug them. They can sit down. They can play on their phone. They could write in their journal. They can build a pair of custom glasses. We have chefs and recovery stations. We've got quiet meeting rooms where they can have meetings if they need to, or take calls with their loved ones, or, you know, so it's just a safe space for them to be in. And I went to it in London in 2012. And what we found is, you know, in the beginning, the athletes kind of come because they're obliged to because you're a sponsor. And then they just keep coming back to a point where sometimes we actually have to manage the door and we're at capacity, right?
I remember Oakley House in Kona was the place to go.
Yeah.
That's the only place you really cared about being. And you guys were so smart. You'd have like giveaways between certain times and come at this time and get your free pair of Kona Edition or whatever.
Yeah, our marketing team is a bunch of geniuses.
Do you think that's because they're also fans of the product?
100%. Yeah. So I've got goosebumps now thinking about a quote I'm going to tell you, because every time I say it, I get goosebumps. And it's like, Oakley is not where I work. It's who I am. it's running up my neck now, but it's so true, is that a lot of the people, not all of them, because obviously it's a big organization and a big company, and we're part of, you know, Essilor Exotica, which own us, which is a monster in itself. But it's fans of the brand that are still there. So one of the coolest job titles I've heard in my life is Director of Soul. And that is a guy called Brian Takumi. And Brian has been with us almost 50 years. So I think he was the third or fourth employee at Oakley, and he's still there driving the brand direction. And we had a chat before the podcast on sort of future genesis and this brave new world that's coming. And that's Brian Takumi himself taking it. So imagine being with a brand since the start and now being in charge of leading the next phase. Like, very few brands, maybe Nike with Phil Knight, or you know, Kevin Plank maybe with Under Armour, or there's a few guys, but there's not many brands. It's still, and a lot of the luxury guys, and that's why you still see the old, you know, Versace's or Armani families still there, still present, because they still, it's their brand, and it's not because they're getting paid to be there. They want to be there. They want to be part of it. And so what we find with Oakley is, and of course not everyone who works with us, but generally, like, you protect it, right? It's your baby. It's like when people talk about Oakley negatively or have an issue with it, it's personal. It's because it's so inbred in us as a fan and as someone that's responsible for kind of where it's going. It's deeply personal.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, how does it feel then when, obviously I'm a Geraint Thomas fan.
Yes.
The classic G's. When they changed... They went to Sun God, wasn't it?
Yeah, they went to Sun God, which is an interesting brand in itself. I think...
Is that the reason why they didn't have a good year on the bike, do you think?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. But I think Geraint Thomas was probably the most upset than anybody that changed. I think the rumor we've heard... So Mark Cavendish has an insane collection as well. Like, he's been with us 15, 16 years. Yeah. He's got 4 Oakley Towers in his house, which we've seen pictures of. Geraint Thomas, the rumor is he had 80 pairs of that white racing jacket.
Yeah, I'd heard that actually, because they didn't make it anymore or something.
Yeah, we've discontinued it. I've got two or three pairs in my collection. It was never really my top favorite one. But it's quite weird how that just became the Geraint Thomas start, right? Like, he refused to change it. But as a sponsor as well, it was also very frustrating for us, because we want him to wear the new stuff because he is... who he is in the world, and he just flat out refused. I think I can remember maybe 4 or 5 days in total across the whole sponsorship where he wore something else. But yeah, of course we miss him. Ineos, we're a great team to work with. We've had amazing success with Jumbo this season, having won pretty much everything.
Yeah,
and a lot of excitement and exciting racing on how that all went about. And so, yeah, it's been great to be a part of that journey. But it's also great that other brands are stepping up. You know, we can't sponsor the whole pro peloton. You know, so we have our 3 key teams right now, and there's something exciting that I can't tell you just yet that's coming for us as a brand in cycling. Because cycling and Oakley are married. And I keep, completely. Like, you cannot have cycling without Oakley completely. And Oakley without cycling. Yeah. So.
And it's funny when you hear of people who you knew used to be Oakley athletes talking of another brand, and you just think, nah.
Doesn't fit, right?
Doesn't fit.
Yeah, it doesn't fit. Yeah. I think at the end of their careers, generally a guy jumps for a paycheck somewhere else. And the moment that contract is finished, they go back into the Oakleys. Yeah. And it's strange. The guys that we have lost, like Geraint Thomas as an example, I bet you he still has those Oakleys sitting in his house.
100%.
And the moment he doesn't contractually have to wear something else, I bet you he goes back into them. Right? And
well, they even tried to mimic the same design, didn't they?
They've tried.
Gee, yeah.
They've tried, yeah.
You also came out with a really cool Tour de France edition.
Yes.
This year, which I also like that about the brand, is like we or Joe Bloggs can wear the same glasses as the guys who are riding in the peloton are wearing.
100%.
Which is a really cool thing to have as well. And I think whenever a brand manages to get that, you think of like the Adidas Predator boot when they were first launched in football and rugby. You know, I'm wearing the same boot as what they're wearing on the pitch. I think certain extent, same with bikes and cycling. You can, if you've got enough money, ride the same bikes as them. But the eyewear is something that's very, you can afford to, you know, and that's a really cool part to it as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think with cycling, often the amateurs have better bikes than the professionals because then they're not, you know, stuck eyewear. On, and by restrictions on UCI with that 6.8 limit, which is just like they need to change that. It's stupid. You know, so.
Yeah. But when you came out with the full wrapped lens.
Yeah.
I really wasn't a fan at the start.
I remember. I
looked at it and like, oh, I don't know what is going on there. I didn't like the look of it because obviously it's just something that we're not used to to seeing. But the minute I put them on and started wearing them, I was like, oh, okay, well, how I look, I don't care. Because suddenly you don't feel like you're wearing a pair of glasses, which is a really nice thing actually, but you've obviously got the lens protection and they just feel good on your face as well. When you were launching that product, I'm sure you liked them at the start.
No, I didn't actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, quite controversially actually, because everybody like turned to me in the first meeting we saw them. He's like, "What do you think?" And I'm like, "They need to be deeper. I think they're a bit shallow for me personally." Was my first thoughts, and then exactly like you know, and because like I wear the product, I use the product. I'm lucky enough to get some stuff before it launches sometimes from sort of testing, and because I have so many of the older stuff, and because you know I've been competitive for 40 odd years now, like I'm also a consumer, and when I first saw them I thought I'm not so sure, and then we had a few lenses coming off because the first time you do anything there's always complications, right? And because we're Oakley, people expect us to get it right from the start, and often we don't because it's experimental, it's disruptive. We, you know, no one's done lenses like that before, no one had done the attachment of how the lenses attach to the temples before, and so of course we had teething problems, of course, you know, some of them were falling apart. But exactly to what you said, every time I wear them I do think, oh, this is such a great pair of glasses. And what's super interesting for me is here locally, I see so many of them on the road. Like we can physically see more and more and more people wearing them. And I think that's exactly that you wouldn't necessarily go in and even try them on. But I think what's happening is once you finish a ride at a coffee shop or something and there's a pair on the table, you say, do you mind if I put them on? Yeah. And then you're like, oh my goodness. Yeah. Because again, the lens is just so incredible, right?
Yeah, it almost enhances your vision.
Well, that's what prism is. The actual definition of prism is enhancing color and definition. That's the quick statement piece for it. And in our showroom, we have a big window. And often I say to the people we're selling to, put it on, look out the window. And then put on a blue lens, a green lens, the violet lens, and see the difference, because there's a visible difference of how it looks and feels when you use the lenses.
Yeah. No, there are great glass, and kind of excited. How do you innovate from that?
Oh, we have really cool stuff coming.
Look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, man.
I have to take you off on a different tangent.
Sure.
Same within the same realm, but I'm really interested to hear where you think the triathlon space, or, you know, can put into that a bit of trail running and sort of the endurance space as it is now.
Yeah.
Gone from one or two races a year that were really key for people, to big name people to win. And now we're looking at these series being launched by PTO, UTMB, Ironman have now announced that they're going to start doing a series. How does that sit with you as someone who's been competitive in the sport for the last, like you say, 40 years?
Look, I think sport needs to move forward. And I think the older we get, I mean, I'm in an age now where I start to tell my daughter when I was your age, you know, and the first time I said it, I actually laughed out loud because I thought, oh, I swore I would never be that dad, right? But I think we just do. And I think it's part of sort of imparting our knowledge and experience and giving a reference point for them. Because in Dubai, our kids don't grow up in a normal world, right? Like this is Disneyland in a lot of ways. And so I think sport needs to move forward. And I don't want to be one of those guys that, oh, it needs to be like this or needs to be like that. Like I love change. I love being challenged. I love new environments. And I think it's really good for sport to evolve. I also think that perhaps sport doesn't always evolve in the right way, and that it resets itself. And I think Ironman's a great example of that. I think due to the change in ownership and due to the change in philosophy, trying to maximize people on course, putting too many people on courses to just try and make more money wasn't a good move. And they're experimenting, right? We just saw Kona for the ladies and the men race in Nice. First time we've ever had split world champs. The ladies were... And it was very interesting. I don't know if you saw on social media, but they did interviews with pros and also just with normal age group women on would they prefer to have men on the course or not. Did you see that?
I didn't.
So it was super interesting. And it was almost 50-50. Like a lot, the women were like, it's nice to have our own day, but we miss the energy and miss the excitement of the men. Other women were like, no, this is where how it should be. And it's so much nicer moving around and everything's just easier. And there's a lot more space for women and also giving them their time in the sun to get more coverage. Because I think one of the big things with women's sports at the moment is they always want equality, right? Why are the women not paid the same as the men? Why is the prize money not the same? And I think for me, it always boils down to a very simple equation of advertising. Like the women's sports do not bring in the same revenue as the men do. And so it's not possible to get paid the same. Yeah. Now, having separate days like that and the Tour de Femme and stuff that's coming for women's cycling now enables them to get that time in the sun and enables them to give that sponsorship primetime TV, which means more money will come into the sports, which hopefully then the women get paid more money and can make a pro living from it. So I think, and organizations like the PTO, I would think, and even Super League Triathlon with Chris McCormack, he's done. And I think the formula for me was pretty simple. They made it exciting. If you remember cricket a few years back, or 10, 15 years back, it was kind of one days and 5 days. And then the T20s came in and you could go after work, 4 hours with your children, you know, drink a few beers, watch 2-3 hours of cricket, there was a winner and you could go home, right? Yeah. And there was different color kits and there was franchises and rhinos and falcons and cheetahs. Exactly. And I think what was the key for that? I think it was a shorter, more interactive and fun experience. And I think what cycling and triathlon are trying to, and also trail running are trying to do at the moment is bring that excitement, make it more eventful, make it more fun, because you know, a lot of those long endurance things were just quite boring. Like, you know, I can watch a Tour de France stage from beginning to end for 6 hours. My wife drives her absolutely mad. She'll come for the last 10 minutes, you know, when there's a breakaway or an attack or something. But so, and I think it's that, like, there's not many of us that would sit and watch a boring flat Tour de France stage. So how do we make it more exciting? How do we make it more relevant? And I think what the organizations are doing very well at the moment are creating personalities. Like, if you think back to Chrissy Wellington, one of the greatest woman sort of long distance athletes around, no one knew her. You didn't really know much about her. She wrote a book that maybe you read, maybe you didn't.
I did. Yeah. Cycling through South America made her strong. That's what
exactly
everyone said, right?
Exactly. And so I think what these guys are doing, along with probably social media, is really like you know a lot more about the people now. So when you know a lot more about them, you would watch it. And it's similar to what the Netflix series around Formula One did for people. All of a sudden, you know the names of the drivers, you know their stories, you've seen funny things with them. So the personalities have come out. And even the Norwegians, which struggle normally on a personality front, they
big time.
they have a persona now. You know Christian, you know Gustav, and so you find yourself being a fan again of people. And so when they're racing together, and I think that's the big thing, is they all used to avoid each other until the big races, where now they're forced to race each other. So the racing's more exciting, it's more head-to-head, there's more personalities, and I think they're starting to get the right formula. I think PTO probably started that, and now Ironman's realized that they need to jump in and form suit. What I am a little surprised about is Challenge. Like, Challenge has kind of slipped away. At one point, they were really rivaling Ironman to be the next big thing, and when last did you hear of someone talking about a challenge race or going to even race a challenge race?
They have Roth and that's
Roth as iconic, right? As one of the big iconic races. But apart from that, you don't really hear about them anymore. And so it's probably very similar like to Kodak or to Blockbusters, where they didn't evolve and they thought everyone's going to carry on hiring DVDs. And I think maybe Challenge hasn't been so, and again, it's my personal opinion, I don't know the facts perhaps on it, but you know, it seems like they haven't evolved, they haven't tried to, they're sticking to the formula that worked for them, but the formula that worked for them in the early 2000s is clearly not working for them now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think races need to be disruptive. I think they need to try new things and mix it up, right? Like,
yeah, why not? Series of races expose you to the athletes more. So you tend to, that's why football and league sports are so big, right? Because you follow the team week on week. So why do you think that's where cycling's going to go? Or do you think it already has its place in terms of the Grand Tours? It's kind of a league in that sense, but you don't always have the same riders riding the Grand Tours. What would you like to see cycling do?
Oh, my personal opinion is cycling needs a business model. I think cycling is purely reliant on sponsorship, and that can't be the way to do it. So I would love to see cycling take a more American sport type sort of like franchise view. So like, again, there's the Jumbo Visma Cheetahs, and they have a kit which you can buy, and there's merchandising and there's ticket sales, and they get a percentage of revenues, and they, you know, they race in stadiums more where you can go and watch, and they get a percentage of that. And I think cycling needs other income streams. Mm. I think, and we saw it now with this Soudal Quickstep and Jumbo merge, or not merge now, that was going to happen. And that's purely because of sponsors. So they are so reliant on sponsors. And I think cycling's a good sport, and the women are a lot worse for sure. But there's still men in cycling that are barely making it, that make 40,000 euros a year as a pro cyclist, not seeing their families for 250 days of the year. So I think wherever you have an inequality like that, the sport itself needs to be looked at. And I think cycling is quite archaic. I love the Grand Tours. I'm a massive cycling fan. I would say I'm probably more of a cyclist than anything else if someone had to ask me. And, you know, and this year, or probably for the last 2 or 3 years, the Giro and the Vuelta have all of a sudden become more exciting. People are watching. No one watched the Giro or the Vuelta a few years back, right? No. Whereas this year, especially in Vuelta with Sepp Kuss this year, we were all glued to the screens. And I think also the documentaries on Netflix and stuff around cycling have helped, and, you know, and cycling being more accessible to people. But they need a business model. Someone needs to step in.
Do you think running is the same thing there? Like, they've got the majors, but again, you can... not all the best show up to every major. It's a bit harder maybe with marathons, but I wouldn't say it's harder than a Grand Tour. Like, how many can you do in a year? Some people say one marathon, you've got one good marathon in you a year. You've probably got one good Grand Tour in you a year.
Mm.
So it probably needs to be a bit of a rethink around the spacing of them. Who's actually in charge of it? How do we get the best guys racing the best guys frequently? I mean, that's the goal for viewership, isn't it?
Exactly, and I think athletics have been struggling for decades, right? Yeah. Like, apart from the Usain Bolt era, which he probably single-handedly drove athletics for 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Apart from that, what have we seen? Like, who
launched the Diamond League?
But Diamond League, I think, has gone off the boil.
Yeah, it has the last few years. It used to
I don't even know when BBC Diamond Leagues are anymore.
No, it has gone off. So what we're saying, really, triathlon actually might be moving to the forefront of innovation within endurance
100%,
sport.
100%, yeah. I believe they are, yeah.
They've gone right from the back.
Yeah. To the front.
Put themselves in the front.
Yeah, and also for women, right? Like, PTO came in and standardized it. Like, if a woman has a baby, there's now maternity leave cover. Yeah. Because there's been big talk on sponsors and around contracts where some brands don't pay them when they're pregnant, right? So as a pro woman, you know, you have to start making a choice. Well, do I want a family or do I want a race? And that shouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's because PTO brought a business model. I think running, again, athletics as their sort of umbrella is quite archaic. They haven't tried to innovate. They haven't tried to change.
Yeah.
And running's a mass participation sport. Like, almost anybody you know at some point in their life would have done a 5K or a 10K or maybe a half marathon and called it a marathon, which also annoys me. I ran a marathon this weekend and it was a 21, you know. So exactly. But I think so. And I think running's more of a... I think it becomes almost more of a hobby or a pastime than a professional sport. Mm. You know, and I think the professional runners don't make any money apart from the top 3 or 4. So the inequality in running is even worse. And again, it's because there's no business model. Again, I think arena sports, and not that I'm a massive fan of American sports, because number one, I don't really understand them. And number two, they take the whole day. Like, if you've ever been to an American football match, it lasts 10 hours, right? Or 8 hours. It's ridiculous.
Baseball the same,
And exactly. Baseball is exactly the same. But they have a formula, correct? They have franchises. Everybody makes some of the money. And it's in an arena where you can sit and watch.
Yeah.
And I think, obviously, maybe... But that is, by definition, what athletics are. And if you've been to, you know, a Diamond League Live or an Olympics, which I've been lucky enough to do, it's electric. And even people that aren't fans of what they're watching get involved because it's exciting. And so I think on some level, track cycling is another great example, and athletics need to be more arena-based at some point. I'm not saying they all need to be there, but you need to touch the excitement of it to then follow the other stuff.
Yeah.
Like shorter races, more personalities. And that's what PTO is doing. They're bringing them all together. They're hyping it up. The social media is really good. People kind of know who they are. I was in Hamburg for the World Cup for triathlon recently, and it was amazing. There was, I don't know, 20, 30, 40,000 people lining the course, cheering, watching, being involved, because it's exciting. And there's nothing exciting about marathon running in general, right? Like, it's so how do you, I don't know, maybe. So I was involved with a company just recently with a presentation where they're developing virtual reality cameras. They're testing it with football teams in the UK at the moment to have a small camera on the athlete's chest integrated into the apparel, which will allow you as a viewer to choose which view you want to watch. So imagine watching a football game and you want to see Messi's view running towards a goal. You could click the screen and watch what Messi's seeing, or click to the goalkeeper and watch Messi running towards you to score a goal. So what they're talking about in athletics and in cycling, and we've seen a little bit with, I think it's Velo, I think, in cycling do it with the cameras.
Yeah.
The purple guys.
Velo viewer,
So I think, how do we bring the people into that sport? How do we mic the runners up? We saw it in rugby when all of a sudden the refs had mics. You could start to hear what they were saying, and you started to hear that chit and chatter. It was a lot more exciting to watch the match now, right? So I think all sports need to start thinking, how do we bring the viewer in? How do we let them into that inner circle? How do we let them hear and see?
Yeah.
And that's why those behind the scene documentaries, I think, are so good, is because you get to see all of that. And you realize it's, so what you see on the road is actually only about 10% of what actually, how it happens, right?
Yeah. And humans are nosy by nature.
100%. Yeah. 100%.
That's a very good point. Cool. Hopefully people are listening who are in charge of this. Listen to Colin.
Yeah, we're available.
What about you, mate, on a personal level? What are you excited for? What are you planning? What have you got planned event-wise? Anything good coming up?
What am I excited for this season? I just want to ride my bike. So I collect 90s super bikes and all the bicycles that have sort of influenced and changed the industry as they've gone. And 90% of the bikes that I have on my wall in my house, people have never seen before. And so,
what have we got? Name some brands there.
Oh, I got a Zip 3001 beam bike. I've got a Trek Y-foil. I've got a Lotus. I've got the first Colnago steel bike where they try to do aero tubing. Okay. So the steel tubing goes slightly oval in places, which was their like first take on aero. A few C40 Colnagos, C50s. I've got a look crazy. I got a one-off look. I actually took a KG196. And I molded it into a 296, which is not available to the public.
Wow.
So I have a few of those.
On original look pedals as well?
Yeah, I only ride look. I've got a Cannondale CAD Mario Cipollini edition with a Seiko red white with the Spinergies.
Got one of the early lefties mountain bike?
I did. I sold it. And I'm looking to buy the Raven. I don't know if you've ever seen later on, Google Cannondale Raven and look for the blue carbon with yellow graphics on. It is the most insane bike. It's a 26er, so that'll still be interesting. So I just want to ride my bike. So I've decided to take a bit of time away from triathlon. I recently had a child, so she's 2.5, and so I really want to be present for her. And she's already riding bikes and loves bikes and sits on my top tube when I do Zwift sometimes and loves watching the screen. And so I can't wait for her to get a bit older to kind of go riding with her. And so I think it becomes a time and efficiency thing. I don't really have the time. Well, I know Marcus's ears just twitched when I said that, because if it's important, you'll make the time. I get that. let's say I'm choosing to just do one sport for a while. I've never really enjoyed running that much unless we were in really beautiful locations, which unfortunately Dubai has limited options on. And swimming,
come running with us, mate. We'll show you some beautiful
Exactly. I've seen your stuff on social. I definitely want to join for a few, but I think swimming for me has always just been the least favorite discipline. So I love the bikes, and I just want to cycle. We're sponsoring the mountain bike series, the national mountain bike series this year. So I want to race some of those and see if I can mix it up with some of the older guys, and then be competitive on the road, and at some point find an adventure in Europe. For me, my absolute favorite thing in the world is climbing hills in France or Spain or Italy or somewhere in Europe. It's just on another level, man.
Very purist.
Yeah. So,
which mountain bike series are you partnered with here?
Yeah, so it's the national UAE mountain bike series. It starts on the 28th of this month. Garmin and myself as Oakley have sponsored it and made sure that it happened. They were also under a bit of pressure to see if it was going to happen or not this year. And so there's six races, basically one a month from October till March. And then you get points and you get ranked within the country, which, I mean, who cares if you're number seventh in the country for your age group? But I think it's cool, right? And as a competitive guy, if I'm number seven, I want to be number three, right?
And it plays into what we were just talking about within the professional
100%.
Part. You want a series, you want to be able to go every week and or every month and check in with yourself and others.
Exactly. And I think the cycling stores have been struggling to sell mountain bikes. So, you know, having something to race for helps sales with mountain bikes. And last week, based on what I've seen you guys sort of going and exploring, you know, we just got on our bikes and rode. We didn't have a map. We didn't have a plan. We started at a point. We just rode around. And part of that, you get to a gate you can't cross. So you get to, you know, someone that shouts at you and you have to ride away from them before he catches you. And like, and I think that the gravel biking and adventure sort of element comes in on a mountain bike as well. You can go and explore. And I think I always challenge people to, you know, don't be a slave to your equipment, to your heart rate monitors, your power meters and your sessions or your coach sessions. Sometimes it's good to just... Eddie Merckx said it best, like, it doesn't matter what bike you ride as long as you ride, right? And I think circles turning circles is one of my favorite saying. And to just go out and ride with no plan, you know, no sort of route is super cool. So
perfect.
More of that.
So you've got one bike you can ride for the rest of your life. What are you riding?
I've just got a titanium Colnago from the 90s, which most people would never have seen before.
No.
I haven't ridden on enough of it yet to...
On Super Record?
Yes, of course.
Of course. Thank you.
But my C50's actually got Shimano on, and I'm in the process of changing that.
It's not allowed.
No, exactly. I'm in the process of changing. So I think it would probably be a toss-up between the C50 and the titanium Colnago. There's just... Like, I've owned... 107 bikes, I think, already in my life. And so I think I have a fair base to say this from. There's two brands that have stuck out for me over the years, Cervelo and Colnago. And there's just something different about them. I've enjoyed a lot of other brands and I enjoy riding a lot of other brands, but there's just something a little, and you can't almost put it into words. The purists, and especially the Italians, will say it's a soul, you know, like they say Colnago has a soul, whereas like Giant wouldn't kind of thing for them. And maybe they're right, but there is just something a little bit special about them.
Who used to ride what are we on now? The C64. So it would have been a C60. And it was my old man's bike, and I used to sneak it out and give it a spin because they don't look... anything special.
No.
But you start riding it and it just wants to go.
For me, I always equate it to the Porsche, right? Like you look at a Porsche, there's nothing that aggressive about it. You look at a 911, it could be very understated and not noticed. And then if you drive it, it's one of the most exciting drives of your life.
True.
Yeah. You know, where's Lambo and all the other one? I mean, you look at it and it looks crazy. It looks aggressive. It looks intimidating.
Yeah.
And performance-wise, it's on a very similar level, right? Yeah. And I think it's similar when you get to Colnago or even... I haven't ridden any of the new Cervelos. I used to work for Cervelo, so I rode all of them sort of... and I actually got time to spend with Phil White and Jim Janot and Vroomen, who started it.
Yeah.
And super interesting guys. Phil White and I are actually still friends on Facebook and chat about things. He often comments on photos or tells me to change my bike position or something. He's a really cool cat. And again, he was someone who was just a fan of bikes. Like they got into it because they thought it could be done better.
You know speed, that's for sure.
Yeah, I love that about
it. We went to a testing day, the first ever Garmin Vector pedal.
Yes.
If you remember it.
Yes, I do, yeah.
It must have been 2013 time.
Mm-hmm.
Went to a testing day at a sort of racing circuit in the UK.
Yeah.
And they were like, right, here's your pedals. Go down. We've got a couple of bikes set up and just stick them on a bike that's your size and go for a spin.
Yeah.
And I saw as I walked down, at the time worked for a bike shop that didn't stock Cervelo. So Cervelo was this like kind of brand that you knew was a good bike, but you didn't like to talk them up too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was an S5. It was an R5 back then.
Yes, it was,
Sat down there and it was that black mat that they do.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm getting that R5. and went straight over to it, whacked my pedals on it, and I was more excited about riding the bike around the circuit
and then the pedals
than giving a shit what the pedals said. And yeah, I did like
on the first Aluminium Soloists. There was a little piece called 8 grams of innovation, and I had drinks early. It was actually, I had the most incredible experience. So with CSC, when they still sponsored the cycling team, they all came out to Cape Town, and the riders that I was in charge of looking after was Phil himself, Fabian Cancellaro, who's one of my favorites of all yeah. time, Stuart O'Grady, who's a complete laugh, and Luke Rowe. So those are the guys that I was in charge of, and the about 10 of us who were working on it all got sort of four or five of them. The Schlecks were there as like 18-year-olds. Oh, yeah. No one knew at the time.
Wow, you're showing your age now. Huh?
To this day, the most beautiful pedaling style I've ever seen of anyone on a bicycle.
The Schlecks.
They floated was the only way I could explain it. But anyway, going back to Phil White. We probably spent about 3 hours talking about this eight grams of innovation. And when he explained it, was a little metal piece. And if you go back to any Aluminium Soloist, you can see it. If you turn the bike upside down just behind the BB where the chainstays come out of it, there's a little plate.
Okay.
And that plate changed that frame completely.
Amazing.
And he said they took 2 years to figure out how to make that frame better, and it boiled down to an 8 gram plate that was welded into the bottom of the frame.
Just balanced out the frame and the
just
frame.
It changed the whole dynamics and the whole feel of the Aluminium Soloist back in the day. Mm. So yeah, like you say, absolute just fan.
Yeah.
And something different about it. And I think it's because, and maybe that goes back to our earlier conversations, when you just doing it because you love it and not worried about making money, not worried about what people will think or say or do, maybe that's where the success of it comes in, right?
Yeah, yeah. The powerful, I was reminded of the sort of power of a bike. A couple of months ago, Boz was left her a new bike, and she went in and just fell in love with the Cervelo S5.
Yeah,
and
beautiful bike.
She's like, what do you think? I said, you can't buy a better bike for you, I don't think.
Yeah.
So it's got it. And every time she rides it, she just gets home with a massive smile on her face. I'm like, yeah, that's never going to get old for you. Because you just absolutely loves it. When you want to go fast, it just goes incredibly fast.
It's got the most beautiful handlebar as well, right?
It's silent. I love it's that smooth. Bike. Yeah. It just reminded me like, wow. When you find a bike that you truly love and you really love riding it, and that's what Colnago, Cervelo managed to do. I'd argue there's a few more brands out there that can do it.
There are loads, yeah.
But it's purely come from we're going to make this the best product we can.
Yeah.
It's not about trying to save costs here and, you know, we could have put that in, but we haven't. It's like, let's do everything we can to make the best bike we can. And let the people take care of the rest.
I always say it's the Vegas mentality of build it and they will come.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Phil said, is they built the best bike they could and they didn't care about, then they costed it. And if you go back to the early days of Cervelo, they had, I think, 12 staff and 11 were engineers. Like you wouldn't find a company like that today or probably ever in the world, right? So they were first and foremost building the best that they could and then costed it. And then what the price was the price. And they knew that if they built the best, people would come. And what was very interesting for me, having worked for them and I also worked for Specialized afterwards, was that the P3 was the, like any bike that launched up to probably even 9 or 10 years after the P3 was always compared back to the P3 in a wind tunnel, because P3 still had the best numbers. And that's testament to, and if you go to races today, you still see P3s, the old carbon P3s, they are still there. Yeah. And they're still quick and it's still a very comfortable bike to ride.
Have you got any Specialized S-Works transitions frame?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to really give my thoughts on the first one, the new one with the split fork now or the old one?
No, the old transition.
Worst bike I've ever ridden.
But that's your Lamborghini of bikes.
Oh.
Right? Looks incredible.
They were too short. The stack was wrong.
Yeah.
And I was working for the brand at the time. And I think I rode 6 different frames. I tried the normal one, tried the S-Works one. I tried the integrated brake, the back. You may as well just throw that thing away. It didn't stop you. It was always rubbing against your wheel.
It was one of the first ever done though, wasn't it?
It's terrible. Yeah. And I tried about 4 different sizes. And interesting enough, so Zip came out with a 1080. I don't know if you remember that wheel. So it was deeper than the 808 for... especially Kona, where you're not allowed to ride with a disc wheel. And Head did it just recently with Sam Ladlow with their wheel that they've built, with basically a disc with a small hole in the middle, right? And it was rubbing on that frame like crazy with the transition. And I remember emailing Specialized, and they said, no, it's not there. It's not a frame problem. It's a zip problem. So I emailed Andy at Zip, and he said to me, Colin, it's a frame problem. Like, it's not my problem. So it got to the point where I had the craziest looking bike, and I couldn't stand. I had to just sit, because the moment I stand, it would rub. And if you remember, if you look at that transition, they got that super narrow, and then they flare at the back, right? So there were a lot of wheels that didn't work with that frame.
Anyway, top tube was bent over.
It's just terrible. But I'm very glad that they have fixed it, and the new one looks amazing.
Well, now it's a Shiv, right? Shiv. Yeah, it's a whole different ball game.
Completely different, yeah.
Interesting. We've probably got one listener left now, which is Marcus, and he's still in the room. Good times reminiscing. I'm going to ask you the same question, and then that's it. But you've only got one pair of Oakleys you can have. What are we having?
Over the tops.
Good answer. Colin, mate, we could probably chat for another hour on all things endurance. And I really appreciate your time coming on, and obviously appreciate everything that you do here for us. You're obviously in charge of Oakley here. If people are interested to go and try some Oakleys on and look out the window and enhance their vision, where do they go to?
Pretty much any reputable cycling running store. We have our own Oakley stores as well in the major malls. But all the good cycling shops.
It is an experience to actually go to an Oakley store, though.
It will be even better when I get the chance to renovate them. We've been trying to renovate Mall of the Emirates for about 2 years to the new look and feel. So if you go to Yas Mall in Abu Dhabi, that's the new look and feel, which we're going for. And hopefully by, inshallah, as they say in the region, by middle of next year, we'll blow your minds with a new concept in Mall of the Emirates. Awesome.
Good. We'll have you back on then to remind people to go and have a look.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.